This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Science with Dr. Carl podcast. We've been thinking about 2025, and so much has happened this year in the world of science. We've got plenty of PSAs to make. We've got some homework to catch up on. So this is not going to stop over summer. It's all thanks to the questions that you submit every week for Science with Dr. Carl. Thank you so much if you've ever sent one in. And this year we've covered topics like, what would happen to a knitted jumper in space? Would it unravel? Would all the thread go straight? That's just one question that we answered this year. We talked about whether black holes can suck in information. And what would music sound like in different atmospheres? Let's revisit some of these questions in this week's episode, All About Space. I'm Lucy Smith. Let's get into it. Rosie in Ngunnawal Country. Rosie, you are a bit of a knitter, right?
Yes, that's right.
Tell us about it.
I just want to say I'm a big fan of the podcast. I listen every week.
We love you.
Thanks, Rosie.
So, yes, I am a knitter, and I was talking with my dad recently, who said he was talking with my brother, and that if you take a piece of string or a piece of thread into space, it will try and straighten out. So I was wondering, if I took one of my knitted jumpers into space, what would the fibres do?
Mm. I'm not an expert in this field of textile technology in microgravity, but going from first principles, there are tensions in the fabric that is knitted, if you're looking at a single string, when you've taken it from the animal or from the plant, and you've done things and you've twirled it, and there are internal tensions that do not, as far as I can work out from just first principles, magically go away. So I'm thinking that this is a bit of a myth. I'm sorry to say that. Is that what they said, that if you get a string, it'll just magically straighten out?
Yeah, my dad was saying that, like, if you took a string into space, it'd, like, try and straighten out as best it can.
And would it go solid then, or would it still be malleable?
Mm.
Dr. Carl, do you know?
No, I'm guessing it would just still stay the same. It's got, like your knitted fabric has got all this sort of complex structure. You've got loops, you've got stitches, you've got elasticity, and they're built into the structural integrity of the fabric. Now, what you've got around you is air and microgravity. There's no gravity effectively, and I don't see how that would make all of the internal stresses go away. I could be wrong on this. If somebody can chase this up on, I'm guessing, Google Scholar, don't search Google, just Google Scholar, and give us an answer, we'll love you to pieces, and you might even get a Triple J fun pack if you're lucky. So we're onto it for you. We haven't got an answer yet, we're onto it for you.
Excellent.
Sorry.
Thanks, Rosie. Thank you. How long does it take you to knit a jumper like that?
I think my quickest one would have been like 2 months.
And what sort of patterns do you do? Like iconic foods that we Australians like to eat, or you know, big advertising logos that are just for fun?
Not yet, but maybe that's something I have to get into.
Yeah.
Or a car,
bit
or
of inspiration.
Something that the family likes.
Do you like cable knitting? And I've done
the face of
like an octopus jumper as well.
Octopus jumper?
So sick.
Yeah, it's
pretty cool. God, yes.
Well, I would like to think that if it went into space, it wouldn't completely unravel. Rosie, thank you so much for your question.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time, doctors.
Let's take it to the universe now. Chris in Colroy, what's your question?
It's to do with information being sucked into black holes, and I kind of can't quite get my head around that. I can understand particles and maybe photons, light, but information, it was something that was mentioned, and I just wondered whether that was anything that you're able to enlighten us on, Dr. Carl.
Okay, so information is a real quantity. Look up Claude Shannon, CLAUDESHANNON. And one big problem with black holes is that stuff goes in and, as far as we know, doesn't come out. And information is actually a real quantity. You can't put it in a jar, like you can't put love or hunger into a jar, but nevertheless, information is real. And can they suck in information? Well, the stuff that goes into them has information and then is lost. And the problem is you can't destroy information. There's various rules on that. And that's one of the big problems we have with black holes. So people have been trying different ways of looking at black holes and trying to work out this paradox, the information paradox. maybe the best answer comes from way back in 1935-34, when Einstein, who was a brilliant thinker, teamed up with a brilliant mathematician called Rosen, and they wrote a paper about what we today call black holes. The term hadn't been invented then. And they said that these objects, this is the best translation that we can get from the original German, these objects, black holes, are not singular. Like a pen is singular to me. I can drop the pen and it's not related to me at all and it can just vanish. But they're saying that Einstein said with Rosen via the mathematics, they're not singular. And then they talk about Einstein-Rosen bridges, which today we kind of think of as wormholes. So with regard to black holes, we're very convinced that they exist because of research coming to us from the Hubble Space Telescope and certain observations we made. But wormholes or Einstein-Rosen bridges have never been proven to exist. So this problem that you're talking about, the information paradox, it's a problem that hasn't been solved. We don't have an answer to it. But we know that black holes exist.
Is it perhaps the definition of information that I might be a bit puzzled on?
It's all up for grabs, and almost certainly there will be a few Nobel Prizes coming out of it. So you've touched on a big topic. Maybe you want to have a career change and do first year physics and then turn into a cosmologist and win a Nobel Prize in 20 years from now or something.
Oh, mate, that'd be great. I'm not sure if I've got enough brain cells left for that, but yeah.
I was going to ask, Chris, you got time for that one?
It's time and curiosity and intensity. The average IQ of Nobel Prize winners is about 115, 120, and you've got two-thirds of the population between 85 and 115. So Nobel Prize winners are smarter than average, but they're not brilliant smart. And by the way, if anybody says their IQ is 160, they're lying because IQ tests don't go that high. I just thought I'd get it off my chest.
Okay.
And for some reason, they always choose 160. And the psychologists roll their eyes and they tell me, hey, Carl, if you know such and such a person said their IQ is 160, they're lying.
We've got Lily on the Gold Coast. Dr. Lily, you've got a hypothetical. Hit it.
Morning. I was just wondering, if every single person jumped at the exact same time, would it affect the Earth's rotation at all?
This experiment was done by XKCD, who is actually called Randall Munro. And he used to be a NASA engineer, and he deliberately chose the website XKCD because it would sound really, it'd be impossible to say. You had to spell it out. And he actually tried answering this question. And the thing is that if you had it happening all around the world, wherever people were, you wouldn't be able to pick it up with a seismometer, which is the machines that the geologists use for picking up vibrations in the Earth earthquakes. Oh, by the way, the original seismometer was supposedly a Chinese set of four frogs, each with delicately balanced balls in their mouth, and it was supposed to vibrate and tell you which direction the earthquake came from. And so the Chinese are now trying to build a model of that to see if that actually happened. Getting back to jumping up and down, in California, they were able to pick up people jumping up and down at a Taylor Swift concert.
Wow. Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but just barely. Very low level, they could pick up vibrations. It didn't shake your house. It didn't make your buildings fall over or cars rock around, but they could pick it up with their delicate seismometers. And the next KCD said, okay, we can't have this around the world because the local vibrations just don't add up and the surface area of the world is too much. Let's try to stick them all into one place. And he worked out you could stick them into somewhere in America called Rhode Island and that you would pick up something on the seismometers, but then you couldn't possibly get all those people in and out and you'd get maybe a 10% death rate. And so he thought it was a bad experiment to do. So to answer your question, yes, you can pick it up with a seismometer, but it wouldn't cause any harm to any natural structures or artificial structures that we've built. Is that kind of what you're asking?
Yeah, that's exactly. Thank you.
Kez in Melbourne. Dr. Kez, what's your question?
Hi, guys. I was wondering, in jamming with the band not too long ago, with our perfect Earth atmosphere, I was wondering what it might be like if we were to do some kind of an intergalactic tour on other planets with their differing atmospheres. What might our music sound like on Mars, the Moon, Jupiter, say?
It depends upon the atmosphere's temperature and what the gases are in there. So on Mars, you've got very thin carbon dioxide. The atmosphere of Mars is less than 1/100th of ours in terms of weight. It's 0.6%, and it's mostly carbon dioxide. So I'm kind of guessing you'd get a sort of a thin, muffled sound. On the other hand, Venus, oh, my God, the air pressure is 90 times what it is down on the ground, and it's mostly CO2. So you'd probably get more on the lower frequencies. The sound of carbon speed of sound in carbon dioxide is a bit slower. I don't know how you'd go with different guitar riffs and drums. That'd be a good experiment for a first-year university student in physics to work out how you'd have to tune different parts of your musical instrumentation to be better in each atmosphere. Breathing, on the other hand, would be another thing, because you'd probably get one or two breaths of carbon of Venus or Mars air before you fell unconscious. So you probably would want to breathe through a mask and have oxygen air. So the vocals would probably still sound the same.
All right.
Kez, what do you play, Kez?
Guitar live.
Ooh, okay. So we need to figure out what the tuning of the guitar would look like in those atmospheric conditions, Dr. Carl.
Yeah, so I'm just been running this through an AI related to audio, and it was saying that, for example, if you're playing on Mars, you should use a tightly controlled mix with heavy compression, comma, emphasize the mid and lowers, and use dynamic mics with good SPL or sound pressure handling, and position them for a strong off-axis rejection because of the very noisy wind. Whereas on Titan, which has an atmosphere surprisingly close to ours, instead of having a pressure 1,000 times more or 1,000 times less, it's 1.5 times more. And like ours, it's 80% nitrogen, but the remaining 20% is not oxygen, it's methane, and it's a really cold temperature. So you'd get it, they're saying here on this, who knew that some people in audio land had already thought about this? You get a heavy, almost sludgy vibe. The bass fronts with the sluggish feel, and a percussion can be surprisingly heavy with a long sustain. So tune down, use a longer decay on reverb to fit the environment. Oh, my God, somebody's done it.
Kez, does that help?
It does. I think I'd have to be a bit of a better player to factor in all of those different elements, though.
Hey, but maybe on those planets you'd be the only player, so you would be the best there, okay?
Yep, always number one.
Always number one. Thanks, Kez. Love that question. We've got Matt. You've got a question about black holes.
Yeah. Hi, doctors. How are we?
Good. Yeah, good. How you doing?
Yeah, good. Thanks. I just want to know, how do we or don't we know that black holes aren't an entry to another universe or galaxy?
I mean, that's a pretty massive question. Dr. Carl, do you feel comfortable to...
Yeah, so we started thinking about black holes in the 1800s, and there was a scientist who was also a minister of religion in the United Kingdom who started thinking about things that had virtually, as you say, an infinite mass. In other words, the size of a black hole is zero. Not small, not large, but zero. And inside that zero size, you've got anything between 5 and 50 billion times the mass of the sun. And we hypothesised these for a long time. And only with the discovery by the Hubble Space Telescope, we were able to prove they existed. And we looked at the centre of our galaxy, and there were these stars that were orbiting around something. We looked at them over about a 15-year period. And they were orbiting around something that was further away than Pluto. To the sun. So if you think about the sun and Pluto, Pluto takes like 250,000 years to do an orbit. These things were further out, and so you're thinking, oh, they should take 10,000 years to do an orbit, but they're only taking 14 years. And the only thing when you do the mathematics is that it is something weighing 4 million times the mass of the sun, but there was nothing there. Therefore, it was the black hole. There's a lot of other evidence as well. So we have proved that black holes exist, but the other one going across the wormy, holy thing and getting out of them, in 1935, Einstein, who was a brilliant thinker and a good mathematician, but not a brilliant mathematician, he's good but not brilliant, he teamed up with Rosen. And they wrote a paper in 1934-35 called Einstein-Rosen, everybody calls it that. And they talked about these, they didn't call them black holes then, but these objects. And then they said something, and the best translation from the original German is, they are not singular. These objects, these black holes, they're not singular. They're connected to each other by, wait for it, Einstein-Rosen bridges. And they go and do a whole lot of mathematics on that. Are black holes connected to each other via these things that we now call wormholes? We don't know. We've got no proof. But we do know that black holes exist.
Yeah, no, fabulous. Yeah.
Anything on that?
The sci-fi, the warping over the black hole event horizon, that's where you sort of, you lose my expertise for a moment. So I appreciate you taking up the helm, Dr. Carl. Matt, does that help?
Oh, yeah, sort of. Doesn't answer exactly if there's life over there, but...
Is there life in the only place we've discovered life is on planet Earth, and every year the astrobiologists have a conference. At the end of the conference, they have a... Raise your hands if you reckon there's life elsewhere in the solar system, and everybody puts their hand up, and then raise your hands if you reckon there's intelligent life anywhere in the universe, and half put their hands up. Right now, the situation is we don't know either way.
Joe in Ngunnawal country, what's your question?
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. We're huge fans. I'd like to give a quick shout out to my husband, if that's okay. We listen to your podcast every time we do a road trip, Dr. Carl.
Aww.
I have a question actually that's inspired by my son. He's also really into science at the moment. We've been listening to a few science cards. And one of them was about out of space, and it was talking about the gas giants and how they're mostly made up of hydrogen and helium. And on the other hand, him being a four-year-old son, he's also very into fire and explosions. And so naturally,
he's a guy, we get it.
The two elements have combined, and I feel a little bit like Darth Vader asking this, but I was just wondering if say we had a rocket or some kind of a spacecraft that used a combustion engine or any kind of flame, would it be possible for us to accidentally blow up one of our gas giant planets?
Joe, you're a monster. Crystal, what do you reckon?
Yeah, so Dr. Joe and Dr. Little Joe, thank you so much for bringing this question to us. So when we have combustion-type reactions, we do need certain components. One of those is an oxidizer. So oxygen, on Earth, we know that flames can't survive without the presence of oxygen. In space, it is famously a vacuum. And so we actually have to, when we launch rockets, bring our own oxidizer to the party. So that is how we're able to sustain, for example, rocket travel and burning through rockets. So when it comes to our beautiful gas giants, they are full of gas. Helium isn't going to burn. It's inert. It's a beautiful one like that. Hydrogen, though, it would like the chance. But the thing is, there isn't a presence of a strong enough oxidizer there to ignite a whole planet. And also, even if we started a little bit of an ignition, it would likely dissipate pretty quickly because it just doesn't have enough to propel it.
But theoretically, if we had a gas giant made entirely of oxygen and we brought them together and then went light the match, it could theoretically happen if we had oxygen and hydrogen together, perhaps.
Yes. Chuck some oxygen at Jupiter and I think we can make it work.
Yeah, all we need to do is get something 10 times the size of Earth, full of oxygen, and bring it over. That's
easy
all.
As. All right, yeah, we'll work on it, Dr. Joe. Yeah. We'll be back in touch.
Thank you. And Joe, for now, you just need to work on your evil Darth Vader voice and then we can make it happen. Thanks, Joe.
Will do. Thanks.
We've got Luke from Bellingen here. Luke, what's your question?
How you going, doctors?
Very well. Thank you, Dr. Luke.
Yeah, good. I've got a question about space, if that's all right. Not sure if you can really put a date on this question, but just had like dates and time about space and everything prior to that. But my question is, how long has space been there for, like before us and all this stuff? Like, what created space itself?
Right. That is a really big question. So the universe began, the current theory, the Big Bang theory, is that it all began, I'll get into all, about 13.88 billion years ago, where something came out of nothing. There might have been something before the Big Bang. We don't know about that. We might know later. We might never know. But when the Big Bang happened, space got created in 12 dimensions. So what we have today are the three dimensions of space, backwards, forwards, left, right, up, down, and then time. And there were another eight dimensions, apparently, according to some versions of the Big Bang theory, where these eight dimensions got created and then they rolled up and went away and we can't find them today. And that's one of the big mysteries. And it may well be that our children will be able to use these other dimensions to travel from here to there without crossing the distance in between. So the current thinking is that space and time got created at the Big Bang. Now, with regard to before the Big Bang, there was a bit of excitement when Roger Penrose, a Nobel Prize winner, we've had him on the show, thought that he had detected hints of something before the Big Bang in the radiation that flooded through the universe at the age of 380,000 years. This is called the cosmic background microwave radiation. Look it up on Wikipedia. And it turned out he was wrong. And he was happy to admit it, but everyone was excited. So the current thinking is that space and time got created at the Big Bang, and there's another eight dimensions that we haven't found yet, and it may revolutionise how our society runs when we do discover them.
We got Chad on the Sunshine Coast. Dr. Chad, what do you want to know?
Oh, g'day, guys. So my question is about, well, I've heard Dr. Carl say a few times that we are all stardust. So being that as it may, and if the Big Bang Theory is correct, would it be right in assuming that if there was another planet somewhere in the universe that has found itself in the Goldilocks vicinity, there could be humanoids or something like us, you know, with due varying ecological atmospheric differences and, you know, things like that, if it's oxygen and nitrogen as it is here and a little bit of carbon dioxide, what's the chances of them being like us?
Look, I love this question because I think, I mean, the universe is so huge. I mean, we can't imagine how big it is and how many planets are out there, how many solar systems are out there, how many planets are out there in the Goldilocks zone. It's the numbers are so big that, I mean, I think really it's inevitable. It's almost just from a statistical perspective, even though the chances of life forming are incredibly small, the chances of life forming intelligent life are incredibly small, the chance of intelligent life that might look like us, that might be carbon-based and, you know, breathe oxygen is also incredibly small, but then the universe is incredibly big. So the chances of those random events happening, I think, are a lot, are incredibly high. Look, there's probably some mathematicians somewhere that have worked this out, but there's a line, I think, in Contact, which is a Carl Sagan book, which is one of my favourite books. You know, it's like if there was no other intelligent life out there, it'd be an awful waste of space. So I think my personal view is absolutely, I believe that there is other intelligent life out there in the universe. It's really just that the universe is so incredibly vast that it may be that we will never, you know, unless we master faster than light sort of transport, we may never ever encounter it. But I mean, even just within our own galaxy, there's been so many discoveries of planets, exoplanets, as you call it, in that Goldilocks zone. But they're so far away that we can't, you know, we can tell where they're located. We can tell sort of a little bit about the conditions, but they're so far away that they're basically just a pixel, you know, when even in the most powerful kind of imaging that we've got. So it's very hard to tell if there's anything, you know, that we can glean anything more than just that planet is there and it's in the habitable zone and, you know, maybe it's not tidally locked. So, but yes, I think the short answer to that is absolutely there is life somewhere else out there in the universe. The odds are that it's there. We just haven't found it yet.
I reckon too. It just seems a bit silly that it would just be us.
Surely.
It's a bit depressing if it would just be us. I mean, you know, life is, I mean, there's increasing, although not definitive evidence that life existed on Mars. We're not that special. I mean, we're pretty special, but we're not that special.
We're not that special. Bianca, why do they call it the Goldilocks zone?
Not too hot, not too cold.
Oh, I love that. Just right. Kate in Wagga Wagga. Dr. Kate, what do you want to know?
Hello, good morning. I just wanted to know, what is the likelihood that our known universe is actually existing inside of a black hole?
There was some research earlier this year where they started looking at galaxies rotating. And if you look at the universe in general, half should rotate this way, half should rotate that way. And what they were doing was looking at galaxies, a small subset of them, using the Just Wonderful Space Telescope. And they looked at extremely old and distant galaxies, not the average of all the galaxies in the universe. And they found that 60% of them rotated one way and 40% the other way. And this was weird because really it should be 50-50. On the other hand, it was a very small sample size, so the likelihood, and the way you can explain this is, if you want to really stretch it, is, oh, the all the galaxies in the universe, if you extrapolate from, you know, a couple of dozen or a couple of hundred up to all the galaxies, you say, oh, obviously one possibility is that we are inside a rotating black hole, and That's what happened with the Daily Mail. The Daily Mail said that. Remember the old saying, is it true or did you read it in the Daily Mail? And so it is possible, but it's kind of about as possible as the Pacific Ocean freezing over tomorrow. But it's not impossible.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those interesting ideas that has a little bit of evidence to support it, which throws me off more so than I'm expecting. Mm. But at the same time, as you're saying, it is quite a science fiction sort of leap that we could expect that to be our reality. I do like, though, some of the themes around the idea, because it's this idea that we, you know, there is some essentially other larger universe with a parent black hole that instead, you know, once you pass the event horizon, and for those who aren't familiar with black holes, and I mean, you probably are if you listen to the show regularly, but black holes essentially are objects that are infinitely dense to the point where not even light can escape its gravitational pull. And so we see, not really them, but we see essentially the absence of light that they create in this event horizon, the point of no return. And so this idea is that within a parent black hole, we have our observable known universe, which has essentially bounced into existence. So it's one of those more sort of like optimistic takes in a way of, well, is there a cosmic cycle to the universe coming to being? Because, I mean, that's another one of those big questions that we'll probably never get to answer. Mm. You know, why did the Big Bang sort of begin? What was before and what's going to come after? So it sort of tends into that idea of that sort of like that little cyclic closed universe that maybe each sort of Big Bang comes to an end in a sort of black holes type of situation and then bounces back into life. So a bit of sci-fi, but I really like the question and exploring it here with Dr. Carl.
God, Kate, you asked one question and now we've ended up with five more.
Excellent. Thank you so much, though.
Thank you. And that's it. Thanks so much for listening to this week's episode, revisiting some of our favourite questions about space. And we're going to be dropping a few of these in your feed over summer. So make sure you are liked, subscribed, so you're the first to know when those episodes drop. And also mark your calendar, because in the new year, Thursday, January 15, Science with Dr. Carl will be back for 2026. So if you want to submit a question for our debut episode in the new year, make sure you're ready to go. We do it every Thursday, 11 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time, and start taking questions from about 9 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time on 0439 757 555. I'm Lucy Smith. I hope you're having an excellent holiday season. This episode was produced by Josh Brennan, and we'll catch you next week. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack Podcast. It's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.